Hello, everyone, and welcome into Debate Night yet again. We're back in studio, so no more virtual Brody. Actually, last time we did this, it was virtual me and you and
it
Silas.
Was double, triple virtual.
Were you on the last one, Silas?
Yeah, man. Like, what, they come on. You're forgetting about me?
I don't have video of you.
I don't think they had video of him.
Yes.
No, they did at the very beginning. He started the show, I remember.
Oh, you recorded yourself separately. We couldn't see you.
No, we couldn't see. That's how we do the show all the
yeah,
time.
Yeah, never see for you. I can normally see you.
I never see Silas.
Brody can never see me.
I can't see Silas right now.
Yeah. Oh, well, you're
perfect.
Right.
That's how we want it. I've got a great angle at Silas. Yeah, yeah. Straight through the two lights.
I just need to lean back a little bit. It's okay.
But yeah, back in Virginia, fresh off of your first ever top three in an Elite Series event. Mm. And it was one heck of an Elite Series event because most of the talk from the fan side was about the conditions, the course design. Some people had some not so nice things to say about the course design. Yeah. Some people loved the course design. And from what I've understood, it was somewhat similar among the players, where some people loved it and thought it was great. Some people were like, this sucks. And everyone thought the weather sucked. I mean, there's no way around the wind. But walk us through, I mean, what do we even talk about first? Walk us through, I guess I want to know less about this. We'll talk about the middle rounds later. I want to know final round. That was your first lead card, correct? Because you're on chase card the second day, third day?
Third day lead card.
You're on third day lead card as well.
Yeah.
Okay.
Double.
So final round lead card, though, is a whole different thing.
Mm-hmm.
What was that like? You know, name announced, that pressure of, hey, I'm actually here. I've got one round to push for the win. What was like your mindset going into that round?
Yeah. No, it was, I was four back from Ricky. I knew it was going to be extremely difficult to catch him, especially with the conditions, you know, being, you know, more mild that day. It was still windy, but not nearly anything we had seen the previous days. And I knew my only chance really was to apply pressure early. Mm-hmm. I knew that was my only shot. If he had, you know, four or five shots on me going into the back nine, it probably was too late at that point. I knew the only chance was to try to make a push early, close that gap, and put some, you know, pressure on him of being like, holy crap, Brody is like one shot behind me.
Yeah.
Two shots, whatever it may have been. And that was kind of my mindset, is like trying to get out the gates early, apply pressure early, and then see what happens on the back nine. Didn't go my way, but all in all, it was an incredible experience, that's for sure. There's something to putting yourself in a position to be able to actually take down a tournament, right?
Yeah.
And it's, you know, after that, I talked to Ezra a little bit too afterwards, because he, you know, he's been in this position as well at Las Vegas last year, where he was in a position on the final day to win. Turned out Eagle just went berserk mode, right?
Yeah.
And ended up winning. But something that I thought was very interesting that he said, and probably very wise, was he, after that tournament, he felt like that should be like his normal. Like he felt like if he wasn't playing at that level, that he was like playing below his average, if that makes sense. And he said that it caused for some issues, I guess, with his mental game a little bit leading after that. And I was very thankful he said that to me, because I feel like that's some really good knowledge of like, okay. And that was something that I tried to do in the tournament myself, is I kept trying to explain, or, you know, convince myself of, okay, you're in second place right now. Tomorrow, though, you can go out and shoot 5 under, but you could also go out and shoot 10 over.
Yeah.
Whatever happens, you just have to deal with that as it comes. But going, I never went into rounds being like, I'm shooting 5 under today. I have to shoot 5 under today. I did a good job at this tournament of taking what happened and dealing with it, and then just persevering and going on to the next shot, the next hole.
Yeah, which obviously that was the most notable in the final round, because we were actually all just talking about it before we went live. We talked about it a little bit today. I don't think any of us were actually watching live your last few holes, because, well, for lack of better terms, we either just didn't want to see it, or we had given up on hope of something turning around. But, obviously you somehow didn't. Being in the midst of, because I've been in those rounds where you had what, four holes in the middle where you went OB on your drives?
I don't even know if it was just four. It felt like every tee shot was just going OB.
Yeah. So how on earth did you keep yourself in like a focused, calm mindset to where you were actually able to get the birdies necessary to finish in the top three?
So I felt like I only had thrown one bad shot. As crazy as that sounds,
yeah.
The shot on hole four, spoiler alert, I was not going for the birdie. So I did get some tweets and stuff from people being like, hey, like, do you feel like trying to go for the birdie on hole four was the bad mistake? And I was like, what does that mean? Go for the, and I was like trying to think what hole that was. And I was like, the one that I threw it like on the highway. I was like, I was trying to throw a straight shot there. I really felt like I was actually throwing the disc really well.
Yeah.
I was just really struggling at the time of disc selection and angle control, of like figuring out exactly what angle. We had just gone from playing like extremely windy conditions to not extremely windy conditions. And I was just struggling to like just find a fairway. It felt like I was either picking the wrong disc or picking the right disc and not throwing it on the right angle. And so I was making mistake after mistake, but I wasn't feeling like I was throwing bad. Hole four, that was kind of a shank. I turned it over way more than I wanted to and just didn't really commit to the shot. And so that was like the one shot that I really felt in the front nine, like, oh, that wasn't very good. But other than that, I felt like I was actually throwing like decent shots. They were just going out of bounds.
So you were like executing the shot you wanted, but
the disc
wasn't doing what you expected.
Yeah, or I was like, crap, I should have put that on flat, and I put it on hyzer, and it just went out. So I was making the mistakes, but at the same time, it didn't feel like my game was just like nowhere to be found.
Yeah.
And so I knew like, okay, just continue to power through. And the entire round, I was literally trying to figure out how to throw a straight shot. Like, how do I get this disc to just, because that's what you need. You need disc to just go straight, don't really fade too much, and just stay in the fairway. And 18, unfortunately, was the first one that I finally executed, which probably was the most difficult shot of the entire tournament, to throw that straight shot all the way up the fairway with trouble right, trouble left. But I finally kind of did it on that one, and it felt great, obviously. But it was funny because on hole 18, I looked at Ricky, and I was like, after watching him play, and I feel like he had a pretty flawless round. It's very difficult to have a bogey-free round out there. There's just so much trouble.
Yeah.
But I felt like he did a pretty flawless job that final round of just kind of playing the course. And the one thing I noticed is he was throwing so many forehands off the tee. And thinking about it and going through it, I'm like, gosh, the forehand on so many of those tee shots is such a good play, because it puts you in a position, if you throw a good one, to birdie. But if you throw a bad one, it still puts you in a position to have to make a more difficult second shot for a birdie, but you're in bounds.
Yeah.
And that's the key of this whole tournament, is I feel like I did a really good job at Jones throwing the disc in bounds. And then I went to Emporia and I just threw it out of bounds all over the place. Some might say that's because I didn't get practice rounds at Emporia. I only got one round at Supreme, but truthfully, are the lights just going nuts behind us?
It's just going crazy. Yeah. I was trying to slow it down. I was trying to slow it down discreetly. it was like a carnival behind us.
But no, truthfully, like, I just never really felt comfortable on any of the tee shots. And I think that was, I could kind of hide that a little bit more on the third round because of how windy it was. And there really wasn't that much decision-making when it comes to like what disc to throw. Cause when you're throwing into a 30 mile per hour headwind, it's like whatever the most overstable disc you have. But Sunday was such good scoring conditions. And I just never felt like, yeah, this is the shot. It's definitely going to find the fairway. And I was just struggling through that round. But obviously, I'm never going to give up. I'm never going to count myself out of it. And, I battled to a good finish there.
Yeah. Okay. So we got to walk through a few different things, because obviously, we're coming back here for Worlds in September. And from the fan side, one of the takes I got a lot was mainly regarding, because the golf course, we've heard it time and time again, golf courses are boring, golf courses are this or that, people don't like golf courses, that's fine, whatever. But Jones Supreme, I felt like a lot of people still with this tournament were talking about how the rounds looked boring. And I was talking with Trevor, I don't know if this was on the podcast, I think it was on Grip Locked, where my take was, I think that what it was the difficulty that y'all had out on the course wasn't coming through to us as a viewer.
Mm-hmm.
So when y'all were struggling, it just looked like a boring round versus like in North Woods or like when there's woods, it's easy to translate the difficulty. What was your take as a player on Jones Supreme, just like course wise? I know obviously the wind changed everything,
sure,
but not wind, course wise, like design wise, do you feel like that's a really good course for Worlds?
I think it's a pretty solid course. I think there's a couple things they're going to have to maybe tweak a little bit. Hole 10, for example, is a pretty tough par 4. I believe they said on coverage I had the best drive on that hole. I think I had 350 out and still had not a real good shot at the basket. You're still kind of throwing it up there and hoping it kind of just gets through. So either they probably need to like clean up the ceiling a little bit on that hole, or maybe pull a tree out of the fairway to just kind of widen it up a little bit to give you a lane. But if they could figure out a way of making hole one not hole one, I don't know how. I was going to ask you about that. Yeah, I think it's a great hole. I don't think it's a great starting hole.
Yeah, I described it like Ben Simmons. Have you heard the whole thing with Ben Simmons recently? Mm. So JJ Redick on his podcast was talking about Ben Simmons, and he was like, the whole issue with Ben Simmons' jump shot is that he's not left-handed. He just doesn't know it yet.
Okay.
He's actually a right-handed player.
Okay.
And so he keeps trying to force his left hand, but really he's right-handed, and when he shoots right-handed, blah, blah, blah. So Ben Simmons, right-handed player, thinks he's left-handed. Hole one is hole 16 or 17. It just thinks it's hole one right
now. Yeah.
Essentially.
I think if they can figure out a different reroute to make that later in the round, I think that's really interesting, because then you'll see the different strategy of maybe some people laying up. And the layup play, I never did the layup play.
Yeah, I was curious about that, because last week on the podcast, you were talking about how you thought on lead cards you might see 2, 3, 4 people decide to lay up a 100-foot shot and then go for it. But then obviously once you got out there, you didn't do that.
I didn't do it. A lot of people did. Like Ricky laid up, I believe, one round.
Yeah, he went OB one round and then hit the drop zone putt.
Yep. There was a couple other people that I've played with that laid up. So there were definitely people that were laying up. For me, I felt like laying up one, it was like not... You want to try to obviously push the OB as close as possible as you can. I just felt like that second shot after the layup was like not 100% guarantee.
Mm.
So it's like if I go OB, I can just pitch up from the drop zone and take a 4.
Yeah.
If I lay up, then go OB, now I'm bringing 5 into play.
Mm.
So to me, it was always either a 2 or a 4. Somehow I missed a 15-footer on the first day to get a 3, which I believe I might have been the only person to hit the island to get a 3. There might have been one other person as well. But I just think it's a cool hole later in the round to really, you know, one, put obviously a lot of pressure on you, because I think it's obviously an insane amount of pressure the first shot of the day. But if it's late in the round, I think it's going to build up that pressure too. And then also just, you know, to allow some people that maybe have the lead to be like, you know, imagine if someone had a 2-shot lead and they're like, okay, well, I'm just going to lay this up. Now you're forcing the other person behind you to make a throw. They do make a throw. They get the birdie. You get the par. Now it's a 1-shot lead with 1 to play or 2 to play.
Yeah.
I think it allows for that to happen. Or heck, both people go for it. One gets it, one doesn't. Now it's a 2-shot swing going into 2 more holes. I think it plays much better there. But all in all, like, I love that course. Wind or no wind, it will be interesting to see. Obviously, in August, it's going to be way less windy than what it was for us at DDO. Do I feel like 12 under or 14 under is out there? I do, which kind of sucks. I don't like that idea. That you know, I'm always the fan of like lower scores and like trying to have to, you know, not take bogeys on every hole.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering how much easier that course will play without the wind. But I don't mind the artificial OB everywhere. I think, you know, we kind of discussed this earlier. Like, what would people's thoughts be if they decide to just put lakes everywhere?
Yeah.
Would they still hate the course? Or would they say, like, no, this course is sick because
there's so many water.
There's so much water. I mean, look at Memorial, for example. Does anyone ever give Memorial, like, there's too much water? Do you ever hear, like, there's too much OB water.
I mean, I've heard that from AMs that have played it.
Yeah,
but I don't know if I've heard that from pros, is that being their take. I've heard many hyzers.
Or from people watching it.
Yeah, you watching really, it, not really, because it just looks beautiful every time they throw it. Yeah,
so I wonder if that's like, if it's not so much the fact that it's OB is the problem, it's the fact that it's just like flags in the ground. Someone I did see, like we've talked about this, like different cuts of grass, I think could very help like the viewers, like instead of just the white flags everywhere. I will say like the grounds though weren't really, that was one thing that I probably didn't like about both courses actually, is how inconsistent the ground play was because it's not really well maintained. So when you're walking down the fairway and stuff, you're going to have some dirt patches. You're going to have some dry patches. You're going to have some long grass. You're going to have some weeds. You're going to have all this stuff. And so I'm not a huge fan of that, of where two discs that land 500 feet away from the tee pad and they land a foot from each other. One sticks because it hits a weed and the other one skips OB because it hits like, a dirt patch or something. Yeah. Obviously you can change that with, you know, your angles and how the disc is coming in. But that's one of like my, I would say, pet peeves with maybe course maintenance. And it's tough to do because it's a park. Like they're not going to be able to like go out there and sod or do, you know, maintenance on the grass side. But if they were able to control the length of the grass, that would be kind of cool. Mow the fairways, leave the OB long. And I think for spectators at home, that would be a more visually appealing course.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. What did you think of, because like obviously you went from Eagles Crossing straight to this.
Mm-hmm.
Eagles Crossing, speaking of OB, it looked like they had most of the time varying grass length, but they also had those massive white stakes, which was very visual.
Mm-hmm.
What are your thoughts on like something like that? Is that too in the way? That's kind of where Trevor and I fell on it, was it could influence the game a bit too much, but visual standpoint, it was very easy to know what was OB and what wasn't.
Yeah, I think that's the tough one, right? Because the OB white flags, I think, do a good job visually for people on the ground. Like players-wise, you could easily see where's OB and where's not. I think on coverage, it's a little bit more difficult to pick that up.
Yeah, it kind of just fades in.
It's not the easiest, especially with how, you know, wide some of the camera angles are. But the post, like you said, that brings in the other element of like, okay, well, what if a disc is skipping out of bounds and it hits a post and stays inbounds? Or what if a disc is skipping back into inbounds and it hits a post and it stays out of bounds? You're now adding in another element there. I don't know. I mean, they had like these posts around a lot of the road. And I think we saw a couple times on coverage, some people hitting the post and staying out of bounds, some people hitting it and skipping back inbounds. So the question is like, do you want to have more stuff like that, of where it's like kind of, I guess if you want flukiness of whether a disc goes into bounds, I don't know. Player wise, flags work perfectly. I think they work great too for the people on the ground. Probably not the greatest for live coverage. And I think that's why maybe some people were upset so much with the artificial OB. But I think if you are trying to make a challenging course, you have to have a lot of OB. We don't have, there's outside of woods, obviously.
Yeah.
We don't have an open kind of area park styles, which I also think are good for disc golf. Like I think the shots that you can make in park courses are very interesting to especially to watch in person as well. I think those courses still should exist, but the tricky part is like, how do you make those courses difficult? And I think the answer is OB, because you can't just have like someone, we've all played courses where it's like, all right, if you throw it 500 feet off the tee, it doesn't really matter where you go. You're going to have, you know, an easy upshot.
And that's kind of been a lot of disc golf in general. It's just kind of like,
throw it as far as you can.
Get out there.
Yeah.
Especially like park style courses. A lot of times the only OB that comes into play is a road. And like sometimes for tournaments, they'll mark off like between two fairways, but a lot of times that doesn't happen. And so you have a 600-foot par four and you're just in a field with obviously a lot of trees around you and stuff, but not like wooded trees.
Yeah. And you can always go over the top.
Yeah. You just chuck 500, well, like for me, 400 feet out there, and it doesn't really matter where I land. I'm going to have like a 250-foot shot.
Something.
So I can just throw it without any care in the world. Whereas if I know there's OB, I'm not trying that shot anymore because I need to get something in bounds. So now I have to go hyzer, or if I go for a big flex shot, I know I'm losing control and risking just being OB.
I really wonder if the fans, how influenced the fans are from the pros.
A lot. A whole lot.
Because if, to be frank, there was a lot of complaining and whining from pros on social media.
Yeah.
Right? And so I'm wondering, are fans seeing that and being like, whoa, okay, this course sucks. Like they're not able, and it's very hard to tell whether a course is good or
not. Yeah, well, great.
While looking at it,
yeah,
and not actually being there and playing. So
a fantastic example of this was the Texas States course, mm-hmm, where they moved away from Dogwood,
yep,
to a more hybrid course,
mm-hmm,
obviously more open. Players took to social media to voice their complaints about it not being a wooded tournament anymore. And the take that now fans all had on social media that I saw and we talked about a little bit was, oh, this is going to suck. This is going to be a boring hyzer fest. When that's not what the course was at all.
Mm-hmm.
It was more open than Dogwood, but it wasn't a hyzer fest, no, by any means. But because the players had first said, we're upset it's going from Dogwood to a more open style course, then fans' opinion immediately hated the course. And they'd never seen the course. So I think that that's the same type of thing on a course like this, where on coverage, it might just kind of be hard to know how you feel about it. You're not super, like, it's not the most gorgeous course you've ever seen, but it's also not like an awful, terrible course. And you're just watching it, and then your favorite pro talks about how they don't like this aspect of it. And you're like, yeah, this course sucks. And then you just jump on that bandwagon really easily.
Yeah. It would be really interesting to hear from like fans' perspectives that didn't take to social media and just watched it and saw what, you know, they saw, because I think what this tournament showed you a lot was the players that are willing to grind out an entire round, grind out an entire tournament, make golf decisions when it comes to laying up, when it comes to strategically saying like, okay, I could throw this 400-foot shot, but there's a lot of OB up there. So I think it might be smarter for me just to throw like a 300-foot straight shot and try to get up and down. There was a lot more decision-making. And I think that also showed too with like how long some of these rounds took, because it wasn't the standard, just walk up to the tee, blindly throw your shot, walk up to your next shot, blindly throw it and move on. There was a lot of thought process taking place in multiple shots.
Yeah.
And so I love that as a player wise. That was so much more like, obviously the conditions were tough. And I mean, I'm still pretty like trying to recover from being exhausted from this past week. But from a player's side, like that tournament was so fun to try to solve the puzzle every day.
Yeah.
Because it was so difficult to try to figure out the best shot to give you a chance for birdie. And then maybe even sometimes the best shot to just give you a chance for a par. And I think this tournament really showed, or hopefully it really showed, a lot of people that watched the type of players that are willing to bogey a hole and not give up,
yeah,
and not quit, are willing to shoot four over par on the front nine and try to grind out something on the back nine to make themselves have a round. And the ones that are wanting to play courses where they shoot 12 under par.
Yeah.
And when they don't have a good day, they shoot 7 under par. And if it's not set up that way, the course sucks.
Yeah.
I think that's boring. As a fan, I think that's boring if we have every course, literally the winner's 40 under par.
Yeah, well, the biggest thing with that, from my perspective as a fan, is it's hard for any player. Like, you're not going to see these big sweeping motions on the leaderboard.
Mm-hmm.
Where, like, going into this final day, yeah, Ricky ended up winning, and he was the one who you kind of expected to most likely to, yeah, win. Going,
I mean,
in,
that was my fault, obviously. Like, I was the closest one.
Well, Simon had a charge and stuff. Where if Ricky would have slipped, people were ready to get in.
Simon had a good charge, but he was
far back.
Three shots behind me, I think, before, yeah, the day started.
Yeah,
maybe four. I was definitely the one. Me, Jake, we were definitely the ones that we're obviously the closest in striking distance, because there was very few people even under par.
Yeah.
Which
was pretty crazy to see for a pro, yeah, tour event.
And, you know, I don't know if that's why some people were saying that this was a very boring tournament, is the fact that the closest people to chasing down Ricky all kind of didn't get off to a great start on the front nine, and so Ricky's lead kind of expanded.
Well, no, I was hearing it in the first few rounds before that even happened.
Oh, really?
Yeah. A lot of it was about Jones Supreme.
Oh, interesting.
Now, back to the course being so hard and you had to like solve the puzzle.
Mm-hmm.
How much of that would, or like your success in doing that, would you put on having a caddy that you could talk through each shot with? Because I noticed pretty much there wasn't a shot that went by that you didn't at least consult with your caddy in some way.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's always, I'm a firm believer if you have someone that you trust on the bag. Now, obviously, this is the first time I've had Michael, which was the caddy that I had at DDO. It was the first time I met him, the first time I had him on the bag. Shout out to the collector group on Facebook. I can get a good sense of someone really quickly on like whether or not how we're going to vibe.
Yeah.
Really quick. I have a pretty good job of like, is this someone that's just going to hold my bag and kind of like give me a fist pump if I throw a good shot or whatever? Or is this someone that I feel like I could open up and be like, hey, what do you think about this?
Yeah.
And just have someone else here, you know, listen to it. I don't think necessarily you want someone out there like holding your hand to where you're just like, I don't know what to do every shot, and they tell you and then you try to do that.
Yeah.
But I think it's very beneficial of having someone that you can just like talk it out and you can be like, a good example is Jonesboro, hole 11, easy par 4. You go a little chip hyzer out into the left and then a chip forehand into the basket, kind of very unique hole. Well, I sawed off my tee shot and got like into the trouble. What I should have done is pitched out, thrown and got up and down, made par and move on. What I tried to do was throw this like heroic shot through this tight little 3-foot gap up and over all these trees and then try to get like a putt at it. And it was funny. Chris, my buddy, was on the bag at the time and he misunderstood what I was saying. He thought I was playing for just getting it out and chipping it and then laying up. And after the fact, I told him like, bro, I feel like you should have maybe said something. Like, that's a crazy idea. Like, I was joking with him because again, as a player, you have to hold yourself responsible. It's not your caddy's fault. Whatever you end up doing and deciding to do, that's on you.
Yeah.
So I kind of jokingly said that and he's like, bro, I had no idea. He's like, wait, you were trying to go for the pin? I was like, yeah. And he's like, I had no idea. I thought you were just laying up. I thought you just juiced it. I was like, no. So I think like having someone where you can be like, am I crazy for trying this? And if they're like, yeah, I would never try that, probably not the right play.
Yeah. Yeah. I just thought that was interesting because so many players still either whether they choose not to or like, I know some players say it just gets in their head, but I feel like in a round like that, it's crucial to just have someone like you're saying, even if you don't talk to them, just to know I can bounce this off them. So you look at a shot and you're like, should I get this aggressive? And you can talk to them and they can walk you through, or even if you have them checking scores and be like, hey, just let me know if X, Y, or Z happens so you don't have to constantly be looking at it or so on and so forth.
I think this goes back to, again, like what we talked about of like this tournament is a real good indicator for not everyone, obviously, because I'm sure some people just had bad weeks. Like I could have easily had a bad week. I played well. I played very well. But I could have easily had a bad week. Something, timing could have been off. I could have really struggled out there. So it's not indicative for everyone that didn't shoot well. But I think you can look at some of the scores and see some like, yeah, maybe that person is struggling a little bit on the mental side. And I think what you just said is a perfect example of like where you were saying like, yeah, some people like gets to them having a caddy or whatever. Like, in what scenario would you not want to have a coach with you if you could?
Yeah.
Like you look at tennis, there are rules against, because the coaches are there, the trainers are there, like your family and stuff a lot of times are there and they're in like the coach's box. Like, and it's a lot of times like real close kind of to the players. And it is against the rules for the coach to be giving any sort of instruction to the player. And there's been people that have been caught like hand signals or whatever it may be, right? In what scenario, like if they could have like, hey man, like if they could like run over and like get some coaching or whatever, every tennis player would. Look at UFC in between every round, boxing in between every round. What happens? The trainers and stuff jump in, let the person know. there's very few scenarios. Basketball, I mean, literally every sport I can think of that has some sort of coach that you can utilize, every sport utilizes it when they can, right? Tour de France, what do they have? They literally have people in your ear telling you your timing, where people are at, letting you know, like, hey, we're coming up soon to give you a refuel, like constant information. I just don't know how that wouldn't be effective. And that's something that I feel like if that is an issue with you, because I actually was going through some really difficult mental troubles in my game, right? And I feel like me tackling it and realizing like that is a problem and I need to figure it out, it has led to me to, like, Jonesboro wasn't the greatest result, but I had some good rounds and I definitely had some good scores. And obviously this last week trending up, which is awesome. But I feel like, you know, if that is like a mental part, so like if people are watching this and they can be like, yeah, I don't like looking at scores, or I don't like having like a caddy, whatever it may be that you're struggling with mental wise, like instead of just saying like that's a flaw of yours and being like, I have to deal with it, if you're able to somehow figure out how to attack it and fix it, you're going to be much better off.
Yeah.
And I would say like the caddy is just something where it's like, if you can get someone on your bag that you can vibe with and just have someone else out there, because you shouldn't be relying on other people.
Yeah.
Other players.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of people do that, and it sometimes creates some like awkward situations. So if you could have your caddy out there and that's the person you bounce ideas off of or talk to make you not nervous or whatever it may be, I mean, I think it's so beneficial.
Yeah.
It's very beneficial.
Yeah. I've always felt that way. I've had a caddy maybe 3 or 4 rounds ever. And even like my performance in those rounds weren't the best rounds of my life, but mm-hmm. I felt like I didn't make a bad decision. Because every decision was so well thought out.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas like I've played some singles rounds where I don't have a caddy and I like go look back after a round, I'm like, what was I thinking there? But then like at Collegiate Nationals is the best example of when I've had caddies, and like I can, whenever I am doubting a shot, instead of just having to think through it myself, I can just be like, hey, what would you do between these two? And sometimes they're like, I wouldn't do either of these, man. Look at this gap right here. I'm like, I didn't even see that.
Yeah.
But they're standing back and they see stuff that I don't see. And then after the round, I always feel way better because I didn't take a shot that I didn't think through. I think that's especially true on a course like this versus, because there's some courses like Memorial. You brought that up earlier. Memorial, you can get through without ever thinking through a shot.
No.
Because you just chuck it.
That's honestly a lot of courses.
Yeah, you just chuck it.
No thinking involved.
Yeah, it's just muscle memory.
Just throw the shot.
Whereas a course like this, what it sounds like and what it looked like watching is if you weren't focused on every shot, scores would pile up.
Yes.
And like, I mean, I think we saw Albert Tam. I'm pretty sure I saw him take a 14. Not to single him out, but I was just looking through. A lot of people were taking a high number on that hole.
There was a lot of double-digit
scores. Stuff like that, one or two things happen. You either gave up and like were like, no, I'm getting this disc in bounds. I don't care what it takes.
Mm-hmm.
Or it's just decision-making where you get off that hole. Because if you've watched our videos recently, I've had this happen several times. You get off that hole and you're like, what was I doing? I blacked out. Next thing I know, I have a 10 on my scorecard. Like if I would just thought for a second on any of those, yeah. I think that's where a caddy comes in.
Yeah. I would say two things just to wrap up the caddy thing. The first one being just not having a bag on your back
for
3 or 4 rounds.
Yeah.
You can't tell me that doesn't somehow help just you physically feeling better throughout the entire round. And then the second thing is going back to when I kicked you off my bag.
Heck yeah.
Right. Like that,
I'm still the only caddy of yours that's been kicked off the bag.
That situation, like that's what I'm talking about. Where I was when I kicked you off is in a spot where I want to be able to blame everything and anything other than myself. I didn't want to take the blame that I'm throwing bad shots and I'm playing bad because of me. I wanted to figure out everything else that I could do.
Yeah.
And you know, people do this with scores too, right? You look at the scores. Let's say, and I have a funny story about the scores here in a second, but let's say you go and you look at the scores and you're like, holy crap, I'm like below the cut line. And then you end up playing bad the next couple holes. You're just going to mentally say like, the reason I played bad is because I looked at the scores and I saw I was below the cut line.
Yeah.
Versus actually figuring out why did you actually play bad? Like what was the, what caused you to throw bad shots? Like what was it? And trying to find like an excuse that isn't on you and is on some other kind of thing of like, well, I had a caddy today and I didn't shoot well. So clearly it's the caddy's fault. Like,
yeah.
I need to play without a caddy because I play way better without a caddy. Like when you start doing stuff like that, it's almost like you're superstitious of where you're making all these other claims and you want to be in a situation where it's just like, yo, there's going to be some days where I suck. The question is, how do I get through that round and get the best score possible on my scorecard at the end, knowing that today's not really my day? And if you can do that, then you can kind of survive and stay alive and still kind of be in the mix.
Yeah.
Funny thing about the scores though, and this is also kind of an interesting thing. I think I'm on the fence on it. And again, I'm one of those people of like, until it's like against the rules, I guess, I'm not going to not do it, if that makes sense. So there's no rules of like not having your phone on you mm-hmm. on the course.
Yeah.
I could see that becoming a rule down the road of where, you know, you have to leave your phones in the locker room or your car or whatever it is and not have it on the course. Cause I will say, and again, I'm probably one of the people on my phone probably the most because I actually keep UDisc on my phone. So I'm always popping it out after every hole, but, it was hole, I want to say it was hole 10, 10's T. I texted Kelsey and I literally go, because I knew my front nine was terrible. I just knew I didn't play. I mean, obviously, I threw the disc outbound so many times. So I literally texted Kelsey. I was like, what spot am I in? Like, how far have I dropped? Because I knew, like, I didn't play that well.
Yeah.
And she's like, it doesn't matter. Just keep grinding. And it was one of those things of where I think, like, in her, what she was doing was like, I don't want to let you know that you've dropped so far.
Yeah.
But I do feel like my mental game has made a huge strive into being able to just dedicate all my focus on the shot that's at hand and try to execute that shot and not worry too much about what I've done in the past.
Yeah.
Right. So I feel like if she would have told me like, hey, you're in 16th place, I would hope to feel, I believe that I wouldn't be like, holy crap. And then all of a sudden just go berserk and like, you know, really like just collapse the back nine. But yeah, I think if you, as soon as you can start trying to figure out like, man, I've just been shanking the crap out of my drives and they're just going left. They're going left. They're going left. And instead of trying to like figure out like, oh, well, I wore these new shoes and I was slipping. And so like, that's why I was throwing bad shots or, I mean, I remember complaining one round that my shirt was too tight and I couldn't putt because my shirt was catching.
Yeah.
Now, granted, like there might see a little bit of truth to that.
Yeah.
But whenever you like make excuses outside of what actually is probably the root of the problem, it's very hard to get better.
Yeah. No, it makes a ton of sense.
I think we talked about that way too long, Silas. You should have cut me off.
Yeah, that's Silas's job. You should have Julius Caesar, Silas.
You should have Julius
Caesar. Have you ever Julius Caesar'd anyone, Silas?
Yeah, I did. I accidentally hung up on
Oh, that's right. That's right. The accidental Julius Caesar. Well, back to the phone thing. We'll get to, you have, after this, we'll get to, obviously you have a bunch of questions that's been submitted from Twitter and Reddit and stuff.
Yeah.
The phone thing, I think, I've never really thought through it. Trevor brought it up on Grip Locked a little bit ago because he said to him, it was just crazy that people even use their phone. Like that just doesn't, like in disc golf, it's always been a thing, but like no other sport are you athletes regularly using their phone. And I think that when it'll become a problem is, not to go back to this, but it's the most recent obvious situation, is the Elaine King thing.
Mm.
If that text, instead of, we've went over Elaine King's intentions, everything checked out, seems like she had very good intentions, was trying to help out Kristen Tatar. But what if she wasn't?
Yeah.
And she sends a text to Paige Pierce herself, and Paige is also malicious in this scenario that's fake that I'm creating, right? And then Paige now calls Kristen on a rules thing that actually could have got her disqualified. So a very, very hypothetical situation. But essentially, someone's watching the coverage, notices something that players didn't see, sends the text to a player, and then boom. Now, A, there's a whole bunch of questions around that because like video evidence just used, or we've talked about this before as well. I'm watching coverage and I notice on hole 8, there's a sneaky headwind and you're on hole 7 right now. And I'm like, hey, dude. Hole 8, sneaky headwind, no one sees it.
That's what my caddy did on a couple holes for me today.
He just walked up and felt it?
No, he went out early and watched people play.
That's fine.
No, I know, but I'm saying like he did like kind of some scouting almost and was saying like, yeah, a lot of people I saw today were like coming up short and hitting this tree. The crazy thing is what you're saying is like if someone was doing that virtually.
And it was basically live
and
information.
Live.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or like literally someone throws a drive. Let's say it's like a head-to-head situation. Someone throws a drive and you can't tell how close that drive is. And someone's like, yo, that's a headwind putt, 40 feet, death putt. He has no chance. He's got a tree in his way. Just lay up. You're good.
Yeah.
Like
it changes everything.
Obviously, it's still crazy hypothetical.
But it's realistic.
These are all things that... And the thing is you might say like right now, like who would do that? Whatever. When money starts getting involved.
Yeah.
That is a game changer.
Well, it's also something that
like when the money starts going up,
who's to say it hasn't happened?
Yeah, no, you can't say that it hasn't happened.
But like, that's the thing of like stuff like that. And cause obviously like if you're staying at home, you're like, why the heck does it matter if players have their phone or not? 99% of the time it doesn't. It's a good way to pass time. Whatever.
It does look awkward, I would say. Again, I think it does, even someone that uses their phone, I think it does look unprofessional and kind of awkward.
But it's still that's a personal preference thing more than anything. Yeah. But
again, it's advantageous to have it. So I'm going to use everything I can.
But I think those are the scenarios where if that came out, it's also giving an unfair advantage to the later cards who are playing while coverage is going on if that became a regular thing. Because then if I'm teeing off at 8 a.m., I don't have coverage that someone can text me and let me know what's going on.
Mm.
Versus now I'm on a card that's around the coverage time and I can have people texting me, letting me know those things. Or if I'm in a scenario and I can have someone text me, like you were saying, of, hey, he has no chance of making that putt, whatever. Then it gives you, or hey, he's actually a lot closer. You better be aggressive here. When in your head, you're like, I don't think that got there. I'll lay up.
Yeah.
And like those type of scenarios, who knows what past situations could have changed if players had just one more hint of information. And also who knows when that might start happening, if people are like, hey, if they're not going to change it. Cause right now, as far as I know, that's pretty much in the rules of like, if I wanted to sit home and just text everyone I could on the card, just let them know.
Yeah. There's nothing against
that. I mean, the only thing is like the rules question, that would be a blurry line of like video evidence, but I wouldn't be using the video evidence to call it. I'd be using video evidence to make someone aware of it. Regardless. Yeah. I think it's only going to take one thing like that to happen to change it forever.
Yeah, no, I agree.
All right, let's get into some of the Reddit and
Twitter
stuff. Unless there's anything else from the event that we missed.
I might have actually wrote down one thing. Let me see here. What did I write? I did want to get into this a little bit.
Okay.
Well, first off, one thing I want to get into is just, I will just say it out there. If I do ever come across as like complaining or whining about something, please call me out, because I'm going to try my best never to do that. I just don't think that's a good way of going about certain things, of like in a sense of like advocating for why you played bad.
Mm.
If that makes sense.
Yeah.
If there's something that is, you know, cause some people would be like, well, you complained about them not having a driving range at Worlds. Like I feel like it's a weird fine line of like, what is something that maybe we should be like letting people know about? Like, hey, we're at Worlds. They didn't rent out the driving range. That's kind of weird. Or versus like, this course sucks. It's the worst course ever. I don't know. It's weird. I saw that a lot happening, and I feel like it did, like you said, I think it did taint a lot of fans the wrong way, and so it made everyone just think these courses sucked.
Well, I think it sucks mainly because we're coming back to it for Worlds, so it didn't only taint this event, but now it's having a negative effect on the World Championship.
Oh yeah, everyone's saying like, oh, I don't want to see this course. The two best players in the world on both divisions won.
Yeah, Chris and Tar and Ricky. Yeah,
and then you look at the people that you know are right there, the Calvins, the Chris Dickersons, they were top 10.
Yeah.
And then on the other FPO side, I don't know who. I think Kat
came
was right.
Second.
I think
she lost by one.
Yeah, Kat was right there. So,
and Paige was like in and out of the mix. She was never fully in it, but she was in top five.
Yeah. So I mean, it still was like the people that are good at disc golf that played good that week finished high.
Yeah.
The one thing I do want to say is, I don't know if you saw this, because I got called out on this a little bit, of pace of play, which I think I'm actually a pretty quick player. And I try to pride myself on like the in-between time. Like, you know, if your shot is up, but I'm like kind of off to the side, like I'm already trying to figure out how far I am, what disc, all that stuff. So that way when you're done, I'm not like going through the beginning of my routine of like, oh, my turn. Okay. You know, I'm trying to do that stuff. So that way the round does kind of fly by a little bit. And I think when you're on live coverage, this obviously was one of the few times that I was in a spot on live coverage in a pressure situation. So you definitely get called out, I think, a lot more from the people watching at home of like, hey, you took forever on this. I think this is, and I've said this before, but I guess I'll reiterate it. I think the 30 seconds makes a lot of sense for like standard shots.
Yeah.
A tee shot, a putt inside a circle with no obstacles, a 200 foot approach shot with no really OB around, nothing really for you. Like standard shots, I feel like 30 seconds is plenty of time for you to shoot the target. How far am I? Get up, do your 15-second routine, throw the disc. Where I feel like the rule, and we've talked about this, I don't think there actually should be a 30-second time limit, because I think what ends up happening is in any scenario that you take more than 30 seconds, people are like, oh, time violation, this guy's taking forever. I think it should be a pace of play situation of where they map out, okay, after the first three holes, you should be at this time in your round. After six holes, you should be at this time. After nine holes, you should be at this time. And then kind of gauge that too off of how far away you are from the people in front of you. Now, obviously live coverage, when you have cameras getting set up, when you have to wait for spectators, when you have to move spectators, because there was three or four holes that we literally just were like, these guys are right in our way. We need to move them. So like that takes time. So you end up playing slower, obviously, than the groups in front of you. But my whole thing is, did I take more than 30 seconds on multiple shots? 100%. Should I? 100%. I don't think disc golf should be a sport where your disc is in a bush that you've never been into, that first off takes you a while just to get into the bush to see what you've got going on. I don't think we want to have like these like shot clock situations where it's like 5, 4, and you just like grab a disc out of your bag and jump in the bush and chuck it and hope for the best. Like those is, we kind of talked about this on the last episode with the caddies of where we can get microphones, like these, what do you call those, Silas? The ones that they use on football games where they like, they shoot them from way across the field and you can hear them.
I don't know exactly what it's called, but it's like a big dish.
The one like the shield looking thing. Yeah.
Like a dish.
They have the big dish ones, and then they also have the ones that are just like huge microphones. Those are the ones that they use in golf where you don't have to get necessarily that close. Like if
it's just a shotgun mic.
It's just a ginormous shotgun mic.
Yeah, it's basically just like booming someone.
Yeah, like a boom. Yeah. That's what I'm talking about.
Yeah, same thing.
If they somehow had, like I would say that would be like the next thing that I would love to see. Like the drone operator, great. We love the drone shots. But like the next piece for the live, I think would be incredible, would be someone that has a boom mic or something like that, a shotgun mic that can go around and pick up better sound. Because a lot of times the camera guys are so far back and the microphones on those aren't the greatest. I think then you're not just sitting there watching someone and you're not really able to hear what's going on. And so I do think from a live perspective, it is probably a little bit boring. But if you could actually hear their thought process, again, talking to the caddy about what you're trying to do, what throw you're trying to do, I find that probably very interesting.
Yeah.
But again, my point being, if I take more than 30 seconds on a standard 25-foot putt, 100% call me out on it and be like, bro, you're taking forever to putt. But if I'm in a bush and I'm trying to figure out how to get up and down for par, and I've never been over here, I'm trying to figure out where the OB is, I'm trying to see like, is this a gap? Can I skip it? I'm trying to get all these scenarios. That's almost impossible to do in 30 seconds.
Yeah.
So that's where it's like, I'm okay with someone taking more time. Even when I'm playing with someone, I'm okay with someone taking more time on those type of shots. And then we just speed up the pace of play of like, okay, we walk a little bit faster now. Or the next shot, you know, it's a very basic shot. We're only going to take 10 seconds on it and we're moving on.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's really going to be that exciting if all of a sudden like we have this shot clock thing of like 30 seconds starts now. And we're just having guys making terrible decisions because they don't have enough time to think.
Yeah, I've had similar scenarios what you just described on like my cards where someone's in a spot, because I'm a relatively just like, I'm a very fast player 99.9% of the time. But I've played with some people who are like relatively slower players, mm-hmm. and then you put that together with being in a bush or something. And I think that when it like, I've never been frustrated with them walking into the bush, taking time, like you're saying, figuring it out, because that's what I would want someone to be cool with me doing that. If I got in that bush, I have got frustrated if they decide after 30 seconds of looking around to pitch out into the middle of the fairway, and then they take an additional 30 to 45 seconds to walk to their disc. All right, now yeah. now I'm here. And they stare at their lot. Like that shot in your scenario, like let's say that you pitched out, that next shot, you should be ready to throw. Which I don't think, I'm not saying that's what happened with you. I'm just saying I think that's when it gets like drastic. On coverage, I think sometimes they made it look longer than it was at sometimes, because there was times where someone else was out and they didn't realize because you were already addressing your lie, talking to your caddy.
That's what I'm trying.
And they put the camera on you and then you're talking with your caddy and then they're like, oh, it actually is Jake out or whoever. And then it cuts over and he's ready to throw now. Yeah. So it looks like from our perspective, you're about to throw, taking your time, talking to your caddy. Now we cut to Jake. Jake throws in 2 seconds.
Yeah.
Really, he took the same amount of time lining up his shot, but we only saw him for 2 seconds. And then we're back, and now you're at your lie, and now you're taking 10, 20 seconds. Yeah. And it's like, Brody just took a minute and a half to throw this shot. Jake literally threw his shot, but really, you hadn't addressed your lie yet. It wasn't your turn to throw it yet.
That, when I can do that, I think, like, when I mean, obviously, I was throwing in the final round, I was throwing the disc all over the place, right? So there was multiple times of where they're all in the fairway and I'm like way out here.
Yeah.
So if I can get way out there, even though I'm not up, if I can get way out there and start trying to figure out what I'm going to do while they're throwing, that I think also speeds up pace of play. It's the same kind of scenario too that we, you know, I do this a lot too of where, you know, also this Frisbee shout out real quick. The disc store that we have, Foundation Disc Store on Instagram, we're doing a giveaway. So if you want to follow Foundation Disc Store on Instagram, follow, chance to win this. But we're going to use this as, can you see this, Silas?
Yeah.
You can see this? Okay, so if this is the if this is the basket, it's your roll.
Nice.
This is someone's disc. It's 25 feet away.
Okay.
Here. This is my disc. It's 20 feet away here. We're walking up the fairway here. There are some situations where maybe these other two people are like parked over here. There's some situations where, again, like, I think this is something that, is this against the rules? Maybe you can tell me, but I think it's like, hey, do you, like, we're pretty close. Do you want me to go first? Because we're walking up here. If I go first, I can putt. They're all standing here. I putt, and then now we all walk back here.
Yeah.
And now they putt, boom, 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 versus what sometimes they'll be like, oh, well, I'm out. So then I will walk over here, right?
Yeah.
Because I don't want to stand right behind here. This guy putts. Then I have to walk all the way over here. Then these two people have to move.
Yeah.
Then I putt. Then they come back. And now you have like this slow situation. So I think there's a lot of things like that in my head that's just like, okay, those are like easy ways of speeding up the process. Because obviously I know watching people want to see shots. And I think this problem immediately gets eliminated when there's more cameras, right? When there's more coverage, they're not going to sit and have someone for a minute unless it's a very, very important shot, which at that point, I think that builds, right?
Yeah.
Like if someone's sitting on hole 16 and they're super at a DDO, right? The island hole. If Ricky walks up, let's say Ricky has a one shot lead and he walks up and he has a caddy and they're talking and they're super indecisive, they're throwing up, they're like, the wind's going nuts. And you're hearing the conversation of like, I don't know, man, do you think it's a felon? I think I can get my slammer. Like they're going back and forth. At that moment, I think that is exciting.
Yeah.
Especially when it's like the tournament on the line. When the tournament's not on the line and it's just some shot, you're never going to see that. They should be going to the other 15, 20 cameras that they have on the course, right? And just like,
yeah,
shot, shot, shot. So I can see like final lead card, especially when like most people are already finishing. And so there's only a couple people on the course.
I think that's when it gets to be a problem.
It feels like, oh my gosh, these guys are taking for long. But it's like in certain situations, it's 30 seconds when you have to like get into a bush and then get out of the bush, get a disc, get back in the bush.
I think it takes
some time.
In golf and disc golf in general, there's just some scenarios where it'll never be exciting. Which the most obvious is like for the most part, coverage this year, I think, has done a good job of jumping around and showing as much cards and stuff as they can. But there does get a point where the lead card's the only card out there. And that might be for the last two holes. And so it's like, we can go back to highlights. We can cut it to the booth and have Nate and Terry, you know, shooting the breeze. But if it's a scenario like this weekend where Ricky has the win locked in, basically.
Yeah.
And there's like two holes left and it's just lead card out there. And, you know, or even if it is just the final hole and it's just lead card out there, there's not, you can't fill the time with, there's only so much to fill the time with.
Correct.
And so like that whole scenario is way more exciting if it is like Worlds or something where, or USDGC where there is a lot of tension in the air and we're watching Paul or Conrad or whoever walk up to their lie and there's so much on it and you're on the edge of your seat waiting for, then that moment flies
builds
by.
Yeah.
But when it's like we're just waiting for someone to tap out to win and like we just got to watch this whole hole and there's nothing else to show, that's when it's like there's no way around that scenario. Is never exciting no matter how many cameras you have correct out there or anything. So
and again, 99% of the people watching probably are like thinking like, Brody, you have no chance of winning this tournament, why are you taking so long?
Yeah,
well, I'm trying to do the best I can.
Yeah,
right. So like me in the moment, I'm playing as if I have the lead and I'm trying to win. Obviously, I know that I didn't.
Yeah.
But I'm not just going to carelessly go out there and be like, well, I have no shot at winning, so I don't really care anymore.
Yeah.
That's just not how I am. I'm going to fight until the very last hole, and I'm going to try to do the best I can until the very, very last putt. So I guess sometimes it can be taken the wrong way. But just realize, I think for the most part, most people on tour do try to play at a quick pace.
Yeah.
All right.
Real quick, we got a super chat from Jonathan Adams. He's going to ask a question. He said, what are your thoughts on condition variability, i.e. wind gusts that introduce element of consistent unpredictability that doesn't even apply across all players during each shot? So I was just saying like wind gusts.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah. The gusts were obviously really terrible Monday or Thursday, Friday, Saturday. Sunday, it was pretty much a consistent like 10, 15, and then I think it dropped even to like 7 or something towards the end. The wind gusts definitely caused issues, but I think they were manageable in the sense of like throwing shots where they would be minimized, I guess, would be the thing. So you know it's windy, right? And you know there's a chance for a wind gust. You probably don't want to throw a shot. Like, for example, the shot that most people have seen with my forehand.
Yeah.
Right? Where out of my hand, felt great, looked great on the skip, and then a wind gust came.
Craziest break I've ever seen.
And then just crushed it, right? Yeah. That, like, when I came into that round, like, I knew stuff like that was going to happen.
Yeah.
It just was going to happen. There's nothing I can do about it. My thought is, like, over the course of three rounds, like that's going to happen to everyone. Like everyone's going to get some breaks. Some people are going to get bad breaks. And I think it's more about how you manage it and more about how you do the next shot. And it goes back to the same thing, like what people are talking about, like why aren't people talking about rollaways, right? Like if we really want to talk about it, there's many times where someone hits a cage and it drops and then they tap in and someone hits a cage and it rolls 60 feet away.
Yeah.
Like, there are tons of times in a disc golf tournament where you will get good. You shank your shot and it misses all the trees and still works through. Someone barely misses their line. It hits a tree and just goes straight OB. Like there are tons of scenarios, whether it's wind, whether it's rollaways, whether it's like lucky trees, bad trees. There's tons of scenarios in every disc golf tournament that are either positive or negative for you. And everyone's going to get them. It's just how you respond to them.
Yeah. Now, the only thing that I think this could be mitigated is like we do, like it is Kansas, and we do know Kansas in April is the windiest. So like the best way to mitigate it is if I'm the pro tour, do I want a pro tour stop in Kansas in April? Maybe, maybe not. Like that's the only way to really think through it.
I feel like that just makes it more exciting. Yeah.
Yes and no. Because like it can be frustrating.
Right. You're right.
I will say, I do have to ask this. I completely forgot about the scenario you just mentioned, so I'm glad you brought it up. What did y'all see? Because like on coverage, we had a clear as day. Your disc didn't come back in bounds where you ended up getting the lie, where it like rolled up.
No, it did.
No.
Yeah.
Have you watched it?
Yeah.
It came, so the roll back in by the basket came back in bounds.
No, look the camera angle. If you're not looking at, here, I'll pull it up right now, because I did see a lot of people like, oh man, he got up like 40 feet farther.
That was
up.
A big talking point on coverage too, on the commentary.
I know, but if you watch it, if you actually look at the whisker, it was actually a really good spot. And okay, so look.
Sorry, we're having to watch this.
Okay, yeah. So for people at home, we're watching the shot.
It's on Brody's Twitter if you want to see it.
Okay. See that orange whisker?
Yeah.
It literally goes out right at that orange whisker. That orange whisker is edge of circle right there. So I take it pretty much right next to that orange whisker.
Oh, so it was just the camera. Because like
the camera angle. Yeah, the camera. The disc ends up going 50 feet past the basket.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. So the camera angle looks like you took it where this roll is.
No.
Right?
No. This is 50 here. This is 50 feet past the basket.
Wow.
They don't pan out.
They do.
Yeah, that if you looked like now look at it. Now that you know yeah, now that you know sense. That's the whisker. Okay. Hold on.
Yeah.
Now that you know that's the whisker
and that's your
you
disc?
Can see yeah. how far deep that is.
Yeah, cuz
the
like,
camera angle wow. the camera guy right now at this point is like probably 80 to 90 feet behind the basket.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense now.
Yeah, so I basically ended up, I think I did probably take it maybe 5 to 7 feet further up.
Yeah, but like that's a normal range.
I mean, from where we were way back there, yeah. No, so
that's a normal range. On the coverage, it looked like you had taken it where that second roll happened.
Yeah.
And that's what the commentators thought too. And so everyone was like, okay, well, that was an awful break for Brody that it went out. But then, like, he at least got a decent break because he took it 40 feet farther than he should have.
Yeah.
When really, you didn't. Okay.
No. Wow. Yeah.
I'm glad I asked that then, because I was sitting there.
There's a lot of.
I was confused on, like, I thought maybe y'all's perspective, that roll looked like it came back in.
No. We never. I thought was no, happening. I knew it never touched back in bounds. Because there were people up, I think people up by the green thought it. Because where I was, I could easily see the OB line.
Yeah.
Because I was literally right on it. So the people up at the green, as they saw it rolling back, they were like, yeah, cheering, thinking that it rolled back inbounds. And I was like, oh, they clearly can't see that it never came back in. So yeah. I knew going up there that it went out of bounds and never got back in. But yeah, camera angles a lot of times will...
Yeah, it messes the perception of it.
Mess up some stuff. So
there you have it.
All right.
Hunter, back to that win question.
Yeah.
There's a part two. Oh,
okay.
He said, is there a wind speed limit? Like, so that...
Like a round gets canceled if
yeah,
we're playing?
Yeah, yeah. If there's a certain amount of wind, certain mile per hour. That'd be interesting. I didn't know if you knew.
There's not, no. I'm thinking
it's like
should
if there's
there
like 50 mile an hour wind.
Yeah, you're playing
like,
that thing.
Yeah.
I played in Hurricane Matthew in South Carolina. They eventually called it because of thunder and lightning. But we were playing and like, I don't even want to know what winds we were throwing in. It wasn't fun. No part was fun. There wasn't a disc stable enough. But I don't mind that. Because like the only reason I'm thinking that is the whole reason I hate the world distance record, which is like 1,100 feet or something crazy. Is because like that wasn't like an 80 mile an hour tailwind.
Yeah,
and it's
it
the same
was like
thing
in the
like,
middle of the desert, right?
Yeah, and when like when you're
they
running,
they should have. Yeah, you're talking about like the 100 meter. Like there's
regulations of like world
if
record
it's too
can't
fast,
count.
Yeah, if it's too fast. And
yeah,
too
like
much
if you have
assist.
Too much of a tailwind, the world record can't count.
Well,
because
yeah, that
like
makes sense,
it
assisted
you.
But you
yeah.
can't shut down a tournament because of wind.
Well, I don't know.
That's so soft. That's so soft.
Well, I didn't know. It's like, not like a safety
thing.
Well,
what are they going to do? Oh, this tournament
like
just
if
canceled?
Gusts are, I wouldn't think it's like 50 mile an hour. I'm thinking like 80 mile an hour wind gusts.
So you're playing a tropical storm.
Hey, with no lightning,
that's
possible.
That's a tropical storm.
Those things can happen with no lightning, and then you're playing in that.
I don't think 80 miles per hour is I don't think that's normal weather.
It's not normal weather.
No, Kelsey would know. Kelsey, can you get 80 miles per hour normal? Or is that are you in a tropical storm? You might be in a hurricane one. Tropical storm?
All right, so we'll put it at 75.
You're in a tropical storm.
We'll draw the line at 75. We'll meet in the middle. Okay, no, it's too soft.
I'll see that rule.
Okay.
So I don't think there's a rule on it right now. Right now, it's pretty much just lightning.
Yeah.
Or it might be like, it might be more obscure of like dangerous conditions where like, if it's something where like, I'll look it up. I'm pretty sure it's just lightning. That's the only thing I've ever been called in for is lightning. But I could see.
All right.
I could see if it was something crazy.
We're going to go to some Twitter things. You guys, I'll have you guys jump in when you feel like you need to. Okay, so Ad Nauseam asks, what changes did you make to your mental game to help you fight back on day four? So this kind of goes back to what we were talking about a little bit, about where I assessed the situation earlier this season, about things that I was doing that I didn't like. Mainly, I was so focused on my score.
Yeah.
My overall score. And I was lacking focus on each individual shot. And so I've done a really good job of being able to try to, I'm not perfect. I still obviously stumble and mess up every once in a while, but I try to like put the blinders on everything when I set up for a shot and try to think about only that shot, try to execute that shot. And the main thing is try to commit to that shot. So regardless of what it is, I would say I still probably had 7 to 10 times where I didn't do it this week and did not really have good shots come out of it. But I'm trying to work on, like, if I'm questioning or not 100% committed to a shot, I'll take a step off, rethink about it, and be like, no, this is it. Commit, 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 and walk up and do it. And
have that, you ever read the job. Book, Golf is Not a Game of Perfect?
Gosh, no. I'm so mad you said that.
Why?
All right. I thought we've...
That was a legit question.
I thought we've talked about this.
Have we not? Have we talked about it?
I thought
what you just said, your whole mental mindset is like what that book lines out.
Okay.
It's like almost word for word. It's written by a sports psychologist.
About golf?
It's about golf.
It's about golf,
but it applies
baby.
A lot to disc golf. It's about golf mindset of like not every shot's going to be perfect. So you need to go like shot by shot.
No, that makes sense.
And you can't change the shot you just took.
To.
Summarizing a lot.
Our buddy Dust asked, the OB at Jones Park, and if people are whining too much about the OB that was used. Yes.
Shout out to Dust. He was solo commentary on Gatekeeper.
That's hard to
do. He did a great job.
Yeah, I think people were complaining too much about the OB. We all had to play with OB. It is what it is. Figure it out. Guy Fieri says, are you a player that keeps up with UDisc?
Not the real Guy Fieri.
you thought for a second.
Well, you said it. I just had to look over and see if it was him.
Do I check UDisc throughout the round? Are you aware of position relative to the field after each hole? Do you just play your round out and occasionally take a look? So it's 100% situational. Mm-hmm. So first round, second round, I looked at scores before my round because I think that is kind of beneficial to see what's out there.
Yeah.
Right. So if people are shooting 10, 12 under par, you have like, okay, it's scoreable. If people are even to 5 under, you're like, okay, it's going to play tough today.
Yeah.
I think that definitely helps kind of get into the round. But during the round, I won't look at scores unless there's a cut. And I think that like going into the cut round, I think that I'm close. I'll normally start probably taking a peek at it around,
then it
like,
could affect your decisions.
Around like hole 12, 13, 14, some in that round, I'll probably take a peek to see. And then final round, I won't look unless probably towards the end.
You know,
I didn't look at where I was until after my approach shot on 18 is when I asked my caddy, what place am I in?
Yeah.
And he said, if you make this putt, you tie for third.
Nice.
And I was like, I did not get an applause. Like I thought I for throwing a shot like that and getting that close, you would think like the applause would be like, cause it's a blind shot. We can't really see where the disc ends up. So like the applause I got, like I'm like, I think I'm 40 feet.
So you're thinking I got to hit this 40 footer for three,
yeah.
Tie for third.
Yeah. And
oh boy.
And then we walk up and get over the hood, and I'm throwing my clear get freaky, which is nearly impossible to see.
Yeah.
So we get up over the thing and I'm like, oh, I'm parked. I'm inside, baby. Yeah. I'm tapping in.
You know, I just had a thought I've never thought through. At least I don't think so. I wonder, because like one of the most common things I hear pros and people I play with and all kinds of like disc golfers in general that I've played with and heard talk about scores, a lot of them talk about like, I don't check scores. It messes with me. I don't want to know where I'm at. I wonder if like live scoring is a relatively recent thing to the sport. And a lot of players that have been in the sport a long time just didn't have it. And so like when I first started playing tournaments, especially like I vividly remember the first time I had live scoring, it felt crazy to be able to see where I was at. And it really messed with me. Because I was never able to do that. Because what you would do is like, you had your paper scorecard, and even if you're on lead card, I could see, like, I was in advanced, I could see where I was at with my three card mates, but there are tournaments where it's just a paper scorecard, no live scoring. I pulled ahead of my three card mates on lead card, and I kind of put into cruise control, get in, I lost by like three. I'm like, what the heck happened? So then the next several tournaments, it became a thing where like you couldn't think about score because it didn't, like the people who you were with, it didn't matter if I was beating up on everyone on lead card because like I couldn't see scores. So I had to just mentally get in a zone where pedal all the way down.
Interesting.
So I'm wondering if a lot of disc golfers obviously played
that habit.
Yeah, they obviously played in my era, the same era as me, where live scoring wasn't a thing. And now live scoring is a thing everywhere.
Yeah.
And you can get on to 16 and look, but it's
100%.
That's like a mental thing of like, I never used to check scores. I'm not doing it now.
If I would have played the first like 12 holes way better, I 100% hole 16 would have looked.
Yeah.
100%. But I knew that I basically had dug myself a hole and I needed to climb out of it.
Yeah.
So looking at scores, like, there's no reason to look at scores because, like, for me to finish as good as possible, I need a birdie out.
Yeah.
Right. Basically, on hole 10, that's what I was thinking. Like, I need a birdie every single hole. But had I played a front nine a lot better, I 100% would have looked at scores to see, like, because most of those, the back nine, there's not really any hole. Maybe hole 14. Hole 14, you can get really aggressive on your second shot to try to birdie that hole. That hole's very difficult. But other than that, 16 and then 18 are probably the only other two that you can kind of probably play a little bit differently, like safer or not. So yeah, if your strategy is not going to change, then
I've never thought of that. I guarantee you that's why so many disc golfers have trouble with the scores, is because like it just wasn't a thing back then.
So Adam Maxey, why did the win make for more parity than a normal tournament? I think the two best players in this moment won their respective divisions. What holes would you like to see change going into Worlds? I'll just answer this first one. Why did the win make for more parity than a normal tournament? I think there's a lot of really good, really, really good disc golfers that only know how to play one way. And when that one way isn't working on a course, they don't know how to go to plan B. There is no plan B. And so I think you saw a lot of people that they only know how to play aggressive. They only know how to try to birdie. And that was not this tournament. This tournament was how to minimize penalties. How do I keep the disc in bounds? How do I get out of position and save par? And I think that's what you saw. I think the people towards the top of the leaderboard figured that out, and the people towards the bottom didn't, or just didn't have a good week. Jack Cody, do you think there is anything to performing better with less practice time? 3/4 of the guys who went to Eagles Crossing got top 10 this week. I see it as maybe playing more in an instinct.
Okay. Hold up. There is something to this conspiracy theory, and I think I know what it is.
Oh, boy.
Eagles Crossing forces you to play golf.
Yeah, it does.
So I think prepping for the skins match and like that was better practice than being at DDO and practicing in like different conditions you're going to play, because Eagles Crossing got everyone that was there in a mindset.
Eagles Crossing is hard.
Yeah. And it was a mindset of, par's okay.
Yeah, I just five over par on this course.
Yeah, like I think Eagles Crossing got everyone in a mindset that went there, because it had to get us in the mindset quickly of par's okay. I need to be very strategic where I want my disc to land, and that's what you need to do in the tournament.
I would say though,
conspiracy proven.
I would say though, if I could have an extra day to get around at Country Club, I would have taken that, because I did not feel comfortable.
That's
at Country
valid.
Club.
I did not
feel comfortable in a lot of those shots. Thoughts on the winners of these tourneys having a microphone shoved in their face literally 20 seconds after they pulled their putter out the final basket.
And we've talked about this so many times.
We've talked about it. I think, again, going back to something that I would love to start seeing, round ends, guys take their hat off, shake each other's hands, shake the caddy's hands, everyone says whatever. That gives a little bit of breathing room. And then maybe the interview goes. I still think we should probably do scores and then the interview. But I think that also solves it. Cause you know, I wanted to shake Ricky's hand after he putted out to be like, hey man, fun battle. Congratulations. But like, I stood off to the side cause I knew as soon as he putted out, cameras and whoever was interviewing was going to come right there. So then it's like, I just stand there awkwardly kind of waiting. I think it'd be interesting if it was the other way around, but it is what it is. I don't think it's that big of a deal.
Well, it's certain tournaments it is, because like I think certain tournaments, like, it almost helps build the moment too, if like you go back, maybe you don't go back to the booth, but you just like leave the cameras and you give the commentators a chance to wrap up and like a chance to talk about how big that moment was, so on and so forth. And then they shake hands, they go whatever, maybe even like have the trophy come out and like more of a presentation thing. We bring out a backdrop or something, whatever you want it to do, to the green. And then like everyone shook hands, had a second to like take the moment in. Because you're also, I think, going to get a better interview if you let the player have the moment settle first.
Yes.
Where, like, you just won a pro tour. Because we've had moments where a microphone gets in, like, Eagle's face, and he's like, I won? I thought that putt was the tie. And it's like, you give him a moment first to shake hands with everyone, and then you have a much more different moment in an interview of, like, he already realized he won. It's already over, and now you can actually get his real thoughts and reaction to it. I just think it makes more sense.
You could put together like a package of like all their shots right after they tap in.
One shining moment.
Yeah.
Like March
Madness.
And
then give them a little interview after.
Brett Carlisle, what's the deal with DDO not being a USDGC qualifier? No idea.
USDGC picks their qualifiers. Yeah,
Innova chooses that.
Yeah.
And I don't know really the basis behind it.
I don't think anyone really knows. I would imagine an event, like, this is just pure speculation, but I would guess they don't want an event that, like, is their competitor, one of their competitors' titled name, like the Dynamic Discs Open being a qualifier for their event.
Yeah.
That's what I would imagine. Nothing to do with it, but I'm just, or it might have nothing to do with it. That's just my speculation.
It makes sense for like every Elite Series to be a qualifier.
But there are some random A tiers that Innova is very tied to that turn into qualifiers and stuff. So it's very, I think it's again one of those things where I think if this was the PDGA was in charge of this, what's qualifying for the major, it looks different than Innova's in charge of the major.
Lennon wants to know about the incident where Jake accidentally grabbed my disc on hole one. He had a lot of stuff on the ground. Like, he had his mini, he had his approach disc. My disc was like,
his towel was next to your
his
disc.
His towel was there. Yeah. There was a lot of things right there. And so like he, by accident, just picked up my disc and then like immediately sat down and like looked at me and was like, I just picked up your disc. And I was like, okay. And I was like, Ricky's like, just put it back down. It's fine.
Yeah.
Why was he so close to your disc in the first place?
Like, that's where his lie was.
We threw discs next to each other.
That's where his lie was. So he putted, and then
I didn't see it.
His towel was like right next to Brody's disc. We just picked up Brody's disc. And then, yeah, the rule is like, it just goes back down.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's simple.
That's what happens.
Easy peasy. Chris McGill, how much artificial OB is too much? All right. We already talked about that.
There's no such thing.
Ooh, Brett Downing with the good one. 888 versus 999. There were 14 players that DNF'd. Do you really think they were all sick, hurt, personal issue, and notified the TD? Or did they just screw this wind and I want to protect my rating? You never see 888 being applied, and it should.
I've seen 888 be applied.
So many DNFs.
So Silas asked what's that, and that's probably a great question because viewers probably don't know. So essentially when you DNF, there's two different things. A 999 doesn't affect your rating at all. It has no effect on you. It's when you get injured or whatever, but the key is you notify the TD. An 888 is you blow up in the middle of the round, you say, F this, and walk off the course. You don't notify the TD, and there's no real reason. You're just saying, screw it. And the 888, I forget exactly how it factors, but it factors to negatively affect your rating. No matter what you're rated, an 888 goes in to negatively affect your rating. Typically, an 888 is not used because, A, the TD, it's not the TD's decision to make if that player's faking it. That bee sting really did you in. All right, you're faking it. Like, you know what I mean? That's not the TD's decision. If a player comes to you, even if they said it's their right ankle and they're limping on their left foot, if they come to you and say, I'm injured, I'm not playing.
That's something Sasha do.
Yeah, if they say, I'm injured, I'm not playing.
Whoa.
And then you 999 them. You give them the DNF that doesn't hurt their rating. It's not your job to question and be a doctor. So assuming all of these players reached out to Jeff Spring or the tournament staff, whoever they needed to, and said, I'm not going to be able to make it tomorrow, or, hey, this is what happened during the round. even if it was the wind got in their head, if they reached out and were like, hey, this is what happened during the round. I'm really just, I feel like I can't push through it. I'm going to have to drop out. Then yeah, you give them a 999.
So they're all 999s?
I believe so.
I didn't look. I will say,
I've seen 888s applied in a tournament, and every time it's been very justified, where it's like a player just literally doesn't show up or doesn't say anything, or a player like yells expletives as he's walking to his car, and just it's like the TD's like, I don't even care if you come tell me you're leaving, what you just did, 888, it's over.
I think this is all I'll say on the matter. I think you would see a lot less DNFs because 14's a lot. Obviously, COVID hit.
Yeah.
Some people got hit with COVID, but I think you would see a lot less DNFs. And we talked about this a little bit earlier today. You'd see a lot less DNFs if ratings weren't so tied to players' sponsorship money.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that, like, let's say, Silas, that you're at 998 and you're with, let's say, Gateway, right? And Gateway's like, Silas, for you to get to the next tier, man, as soon as you hit 1,000, you break into that next tier. Aren't you going to be more incentivized that if you are having a bad round in a tournament to just say like, oh, you know what? My shoulder's starting to hurt a little bit. I'm going to bounce out of here.
Yeah.
Like you're more, I think that comes into players' heads a lot more when it's literally directed to their livelihood.
Yeah.
And so I think, again, as soon as we see ratings just disappear from the pro scene, I think you would see a lot less players DNF.
I remember that was a big thing. There was this one player in North Carolina that I was somewhat good friends with through collegiate disc golf. And they were trying to get sponsored by Innova. And they had a really good relationship with Innova. But at the time, to get on whatever team they wanted to, Innova said, we don't even look at an application if someone's not 1,000 or 1015 rated. I forget what it was. Mm-hmm. One of those two. And so what ended up happening is this player for like 2 years just picked and chose what events they knew they played good at and did that for 2 years. And sure enough, boom, like 10, 15, 10, 20 rated, and then got sponsored by Innova. Then they played everything they wanted. They were a very good player. That was probably the close to their true rating, but there was many tournaments where this player like chose not to play or it affected their decision-making. This way, you know, it doesn't really matter what you do or don't play, but it's a similar thing where like, it was all based on this arbitrary number that we've seen multiple times. Doesn't really make any sense. When you really try to look at it and try to make it make sense, it doesn't. And then it's based on that. And so players can like pick and choose and be like, hey, I'm going to drop out of this. Or, hey, I'm going to stay in this, but I'm going to make sure I tank it so it's more than 100 points below so it doesn't affect my rating. Because I've seen that happen too.
Yeah.
Which that you can also be 888 for.
Side note. I posted something on Reddit.
I get so many topics for grip locked from Reddit.
Isn't it just like Twitter?
No, it's a forum. You post a topic and then people go back and forth underneath it.
There's a lot of people on Reddit that have no problem with
so in that aspect it's Twitter.
Expressing their minds.
Yeah. A lot of people are just more free with what they think on Reddit.
Just let it flow.
It's a lot more anonymous.
Yeah.
Okay.
So yeah, I went on Reddit and I said, hey, give me some topics. What do you want to hear about? And let's see what some people said. And then we'll wrap up the show. What do you say?
Yeah.
IPATS or LPATS said, will you ever consider a bucket hat for future tournaments?
How can you say no?
I mean, I don't think I would look good in a bucket hat.
That doesn't matter. Okay, that's not the question.
That's not important.
You're going to play better. I did see the company that like made Ricky's bucket hat like had to put out this post on social media today to like do damage control a little bit, because apparently they like sent Rick the bucket hat as like a test thing of like, hey, we're thinking about making these type thing. And Rick loved them, obviously. And so he rocked it matching his polo on the final day, and it blew up because like, Ricky's had like his snapback Rick era, raincoat Rick, and now bucket hat Rick. Like he's taking on different personas, right? And so bucket hat Rick kind of blew up, and apparently their site was flooded of people searching for bucket hats, and they had to be like, hey guys, they're coming in June. We're going to do pre-orders now since Ricky wore them, but like it kind of seemed like he really wasn't supposed to do that, and now we got to figure something out. It's pretty funny.
Ace It Disc Golf says, congrats on your DDO finish. I have a few. I'd be interested to hear you respond. What does your third place finish mean to you? And what do you think you need to work on most to break the top 20 reliably? Third place finish just really means that like, if I stick to my game plan, I play well, I can contend at these tournaments, and that's where I want to be. I want to put myself in as many positions as possible to win. What do I need to work on? I would say, again, just consistency. There was probably a handful of shots that, when you look back at it, are pretty standard, like up and down situations where, you know, the top guys are getting up and down, or at least giving themselves a putt, you know, 9 out of 10 times. And like 3 or 4 of those times I threw it OB, like just kind of like I was talking about lack of focus, or just the consistency side of where I'm just still not that good. I still need to work on being able to consistently execute a shot. What has been the hardest part about your journey to achieving 10-20 level disc golf? What do you think your ceiling is? Hardest part of the journey so far is probably just the time commitment, the amount of time that you have to put into it. You end up having to sacrifice a lot of stuff. What is my ceiling is? I don't know. I don't think I'm close to it. I'll tell you that much. But I don't know.
The ceiling is the roof, you know?
What advice would you give to someone starting out at competitive disc golf career in their 30s, whether having an athletic background or not? I would definitely say, like, if you're not used to the wear and tear on your body, to like start off slow. Like, don't go out to a field and just start chucking discs every day. Slowly build into it. We recover way differently in our 30s than we do in our 20s. The knees are good. What fitness routines have you found most helpful? I've just been doing a lot of weightlifting. How did you go about developing your form, and what room do you have to improve it? So I've tinkered a lot with my form, and I think that's another thing that I've really worked on the last couple tournaments is stop trying to copy and mimic other people's forms so much, and just do sometimes just doing what naturally is working for you, like what naturally feels good for you is fine. And the easiest way of doing that is literally if you look at like some of the top players, Dickerson, Ricky, Calvin, and you look at all of them, their forms all look completely different.
Yeah.
And they're all really freaking good.
I'm excited for the day. I think it's got to be soon at this point.
Oh, here we go.
Where in most other sports, there's like key. This is all true. And most other sports, there's key proponents of like, this is required for a successful swing, a successful basketball shot. And then there's
anywhere
other
you go
things,
between there, doesn't matter.
As long as you get to X point in a throw, as long as you get to Y point in a release, how you get in between that is up to what's ever most comfortable. And we don't really have that data yet in disc golf of like, we know the power pocket, but like that's still kind of arbitrary. But like beyond that, like data of like these, we analyze the top 50 players' form and they all did this, this, and this in different ways. That's going to be a really exciting time, because then you'll really know, okay, well, I'm really comfortable doing this and that doesn't hurt me as long as I can get to here and then get the disc to here and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah. JBM Murray says, what about Ricky's game stood out to you the most this weekend? Playing several rounds with him up close, what made him play the conditions so much better than anyone else? So I played with him the third round, and I didn't really notice anything that much drastically different that he did on the third round that was like, oh, wow. I would say he was better probably than I was at his height control. So I definitely, on two or three holes that were actually pretty easily birdieable, I definitely threw it too high and allowed the wind to affect the disc more. And he probably threw it 15 to 20 feet lower than I did and got more ground play and worked the disc that way. So I think he did that better the third round. Fourth round, easy answer. He threw forehand like on 7 tee shots. I never threw a forehand on any tee shot except for the one forehand hole, the par 3 with the big bush. That's going to be my biggest game changer going into Worlds is I'm literally changing my play on like 6 tee shots. Yeah. I'm going forehand.
Is that something you think you would have came to had you had a practice round or two on the course? Like, was it that
obvious?
I
don't want to make that excuse.
Okay. Well, I wasn't trying to give you an excuse. I'm just saying, like, was it that obvious? Or was it just like once you watched Ricky play his game, it was like, oh, that makes sense, but I would have never thought of it.
Tough to say.
Okay.
I will say once I saw Ricky do it, it was like, wow.
Yeah.
That is obviously the play there.
Yeah.
Tough to say whether or not I would have figured that out myself.
Yeah.
Human condition. Charlie Eisenhood made the case on the upshot that former ultimate players have an advantage in windy conditions. Do you agree?
I've never played Ultimate Day in my life. I would feel like no, but that's just because I feel like
you don't,
wind affects Ultimate
why,
so much
why
different.
Would it? Yeah.
I would say the only reason, I would say the only thing that I felt like I am comfortable doing, and like I talked with Ezra with this, and like something that he's not very comfortable with, is I'm comfortable with like just spinning the disc and not doing any arm. So I'm comfortable on a 20-foot putt just going from here and just doing like that.
Mm-hmm.
No arm, no push, nothing like that. Just here and just snap.
Yeah.
And if you watch like Simon putting, he has a couple of really sick highlights from this week. That's exactly what how he was putting. He was just like here and he would just like pop it and just kind of get enough spin on it to where it stays in the air and it kind of just like floats through to get to the basket.
Yeah.
Versus like if you're trying to juice it and you miss or it hits the chains and like you're adding so much force to where now a lot of bad things can happen to it, where if I just pop it and I miss it a little bit, it's just going to kind of flutter.
But it
next
still
to
has
basket.
Enough spin to fight the wind.
Yeah. I would say that's advantageous. Everything else, no. There's no, I don't know how throwing a huge.
Only thing
lid.
I'd say is like maybe because the wind affects an ultimate disc so much more that you get a lot more.
Do you know how I throw ultimate into the headwind? Do you know what angle I throw?
Probably
an
like
Ultra Star? Yeah, I throw like that.
Yeah.
I was never doing that.
Yeah.
I was doing the exact opposite.
That's, well, I'm just trying to think.
I was actually going overstable like Annie.
Yeah.
Super overstable Annie into a headwind to try to keep it down and low and just penetrate.
I was just trying
through.
To think of his argument.
Yeah, I don't know. I would love to hear why he thinks that. I mean, I would definitely say yes. If we had to play DDO and the only thing you could use were understable putters, yes, I feel like I would have a huge advantage. But that's not how we played. That's not how we played DDO. Do you feel that the OB on DDO courses? We already talked about that. Venom asks, "How big are your hands? They look gigantic."
That's pretty big. I mean, I can palm a basketball for reference.
Okay, there you go. Hunter can palm a basketball.
So, don't question me, Silas. Don't question
me. Like, no, I feel like you're lying.
I can definitely palm a basketball.
Are you looking around for a basketball?
Yeah.
There's a soccer ball right there.
I had one.
See, if you can't palm that soccer ball, you can't palm a basketball. Well, that actually might be hard to palm.
It's definitely going to be harder to palm.
Because that's going
to
be like slick. Okay. Do you believe him now, Silas?
Well, that soccer ball's smaller.
Get
than
wrecked,
basketball.
Silas. Yeah, but the basketball, you have the grooves to get into.
I'm not thinking of grooves. What?
Like the actual like basketball has grooves. Your fingers.
You don't just pick it up?
I can pick it up. Yeah, but my fingers get in the.
But they
grooves.
Have, yeah, they have like little things that you can, get in there.
I wouldn't make that up. That's a very easy thing for me to be disproven on.
We'll see.
Okay.
All right, we'll do one more and then Silas will do a couple live questions.
All right.
iDisc wants to know, why are you moving out of Virginia?
He hates me.
Well, you know. So the off season, Hunter can say what he wants. The off season weather in Virginia, not ideal.
Not ideal for practicing disc golf.
Okay.
I'll 100% give you that.
Yeah. So
if you're trying to be very good at disc golf, Virginia is not the best place to pick.
Yeah.
That
so,
one's 100%
so
accurate.
So the off season, it was really, really hard to practice. And then I would say on top of that, when I am gone on tour, Kelsey's kind of by herself in Virginia, which sucks. So going back to Dallas, it will be nice that she will have her family and friends kind of around there as well. If you didn't know, Kelsey's from Dallas, so literally all her family is in Dallas. So that will be nice. But with that being said, I will be in Virginia a whole lot. And also now that I'm in Dallas, now Foundation can kind of come down to Dallas as well and enjoy some of the weather.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think this offseason,
I think it's going to be actually really good for the company.
Yeah, I think content-wise, it's going to actually end up helping us. Because at first, I was like, dang, this is going to kind of suck this offseason. But then I started thinking about it, I was like, well, realistically, I think when we're not together all the time, like me, you, Trevor, Connor, mm-hmm. when we like travel to Dallas or you travel here, like even in the middle of the season, though, like we're all way more excited to film,
yes.
which just makes better content. One,
true.
Two, bouncing back and forth. Cause now there's also opportunity where one of us is going to have to travel anyway. So it makes way more sense if like now in this situation, if we're all in Virginia, it's a big ask for all of us to meet in Florida mm-hmm. or meet somewhere else. But if we're having to travel to Dallas or you're having to travel to Virginia, it's like, or we just both hop on a plane and meet halfway somewhere or meet in Florida or meet wherever.
Yeah, we can go in different spots too. And
so I feel like for the channel, it's going to end up being better because I think we're going to end up getting a much wider spread of content. And I think that what we have this season that we didn't have is someone actually managing the online store and warehouse so that like when we're gone for a week or 2 weeks, we won't miss a beat when it comes to the online store, which that's something that wouldn't have been true last year.
Yeah, I don't think people at home will really see that much difference in the content that we're producing.
Yeah, if anything, it'll be better.
It'll be better. And then obviously the podcast and stuff will still do virtually and all that. So we'll be solid. We'll be good. What's that?
Finally.
We have fiber, Silas. Get excited.
There you go.
We have a couple extra rooms too for you guys. So plenty of space. Plenty of space for everyone. Just lots of corgi hair.
You got some live questions, Silas?
yeah, sure. The Claw Shooter says, there needs to be a rule that trees cannot be within the putting circle.
No.
Thoughts?
You know what? I used to agree 100%. I really did. And I was fully on team circle needs to be wide open. But circle needs to be strategically planned is where I'm team now. So I think that it shouldn't be, I don't know why I'm talking about the circle as if it's like a third person, but I am. I think the circle needs to be strategically planned to where it's fair. I don't think there should be like thorn bushes and stuff inside the circle. I'm not a huge fan of that, but I also think it has its place because like what it does is it makes you, when you're throwing a shot inside the circle, be thinking a lot more of, I know there's a bunch of trees on the right side, so I need to put this shot on the left side. And that stuff that like we talked about this weekend, that stuff in disc golf, you just don't have to do a lot of right now. And so instead of looking at it now as its unfortunate break when I land on the right side of the circle and I now have a straddle putt from 20 feet, I think of it as like, well, I knew if I land on the left side, I'd have a wide open putt and I still land on this right side. That's my fault. And so I think that it's actually, when done right, should be a strategic design of the course versus seen as like a fluky gimmick. So I used to be on his team. I flipped. I don't know if you agree with that.
No, I'm the same way.
Yeah.
Gotcha. I was trying to find it. It was earlier in the show. Someone was talking about the distance between like Brody, like say you're on your card and the spectators, the distance between how far they are back, why that changes so much.
From tournament to tournament or like within the same tournament?
No, he was talking about within the same tournament. Mm.
Are you talking about like spectators on the fairways?
Yeah, like behind you guys, like walking up.
So yeah, so like DDO did a really good job of like same thing. It was the same thing at Jonesboro. It was just honestly a lot of these pro tour events are starting to turn into this of where spectators aren't on the fairways.
Yeah.
So they're on the side of the fairways and they can get around the side of the fairways and get, you know, close to the greens, but no one's behind us anymore. And I think, one, that looks better on coverage. Two, I think it also kind of separates the two out so you don't end up having some any, like what you've kind of talked about before where like you just end up having some like weird, like
kind of weird in between.
Weird in between where like some people are just like meandering kind of closer and closer. So that kind of doesn't exist anymore, or at least it hasn't in the last couple of events.
Yeah, I think the reason that it would happen previously and if it does happen again was that weird line of people where there's a card, there's the official media, Jomez, Live, those people, and there's people where, like me, when I fall into this, of like social media, you know, reporters, you know, people who are writing for blogs, where we don't have to be up with the players, but our job requires us to be in front of the gallery. And we're just in this weird in-between space, and sometimes what will happen is the gallery meets up to that line of those people. And so where that line is would vary because it's like the gallery is just walking and being directed by a person. And it's not really like how it is like Brody's describing where there's restricted areas where only the gallery can't go within that. I think that's kind of why it's happened previously.
Brody, does the media still walk up with you guys or are they on the fairways?
No, they're still in the fairway.
Okay.
Yeah. Cool. Cameras and all that stuff.
Do they have like passes on like media passes?
I don't believe so.
I don't know if the official crew do? Because like Jomez all
they
wears
all wear, they
the,
all have jerseys.
Uniforms yeah, essentially. Right.
Gatekeeper has uniforms. Yeah,
and
Jomez
the Pro Tour all has all the gear. Social media but social people. Media, we have badges.
Okay, nice.
You have a because okay.
That's great.
I haven't seen
because
those people.
Then how do you differentiate?
They might not be at events right now.
Yeah, I really haven't seen any social media. I've the only people that I've seen have
even caddies have caddy
caddies.
Badges.
Yeah,
yeah.
Okay,
but like whenever
because even support, I think support players now or support. People can't be inside the ropes,
yeah.
I believe.
Whenever I've went to events in the past, and this could have changed, I haven't been to an event this year, I'm given a media pass because, you know, most media people, people have no idea who I am. And so I'm walking in.
I haven't
and
seen that yet.
You can't, year. You know, I've been yeah. told multiple times, like, hey, get behind the ropes. And I'm like, oh, I have a media pass. I'm sorry. Because, again, you're in a weird spot because yeah. you can't be up with the players because that's not where you're supposed to be. Right. But you need to be in front of the gallery because... You're there to get media. And
it's
so
easier.
It's a weird thing,
I think it'd be
but,
easier now that
yeah, on the sides yeah. it'd be a lot easier. Yeah. But yeah, there are badges for like that group of people.
Yeah,
and okay. for caddies,
right?
To help differentiate.
No, I think it should be. I think that's
yeah.
great.
It's like it's like a
it's like
press
every
pass.
Sport. Yeah. yeah, yeah, every sport has.
Yeah.
Nice. All right, we got a question for Brody. What's the best airline to fly, Brody?
American Airlines.
There you go.
I think it's fully regional.
Yeah, that's just the hub out of Dallas.
Yeah, that's all we can fly out of Lynchburg.
And that's the only airline.
It used to be Delta out of Lynchburg.
Oh,
and
they
switched.
It?
And it was crazy because like my dad, all of his business cards
he
built up airline
so
points.
Miles.
So he had a ton of Delta points. Then they switched. And we were just like, what do we do? So we started flying out of Roanoke because they still had Delta. So we just drive an hour, fly out of Roanoke. And then he built up American Airlines points. Crazy stuff. It was wild at Lynchburg Airport. Our one gate was popping.
Yeah, and you can only go to Charlotte. Like, that's it.
Yeah, it used to be Atlanta.
Oh, really?
When Delta was here, you went to Atlanta.
Oh.
We actually, at one
Back
point, you could
day.
Go a few different places with Delta. They treated us like kings. Yeah. But now we have all jets. So you had propeller planes back then.
Times have changed, man.
There was like 20 people on the flight, Upgrade. And it was just two propeller planes. It was terrifying.
All right. We got one from Brendan. They say, do you anticipate any changes to either course for Worlds?
I do. I think there are some like good critiques for some of the holes that like, I don't think hole 4 will stay as a 600-foot par 3. I think they'll probably tweak hole 10. Hole 12 probably will get tweaked to a little bit. Hole 10 and hole 12 at Supreme 18. And then hole 4 at DDO. So, yeah, I think maybe hole 14 at DDO might get tweaked a little bit too. I don't know. But, yeah, I think they'll listen and hear. I definitely know, like, the spectators, where the spectators' roping was, I definitely know they will start – they'll push that back.
Yeah, I heard –
because there was multiple holes where the spectators were in the line. And I don't think we should be playing the game of, like – well, I hope the spectators get out of the way.
Yeah.
Like, they should be...
I
we
heard,
shouldn't have to have
but
them
But that's
like
how it is in golf, isn't it?
No, you're not hitting
that's
golf balls. You're not hitting golf balls over spectators to have it come
unless you're getting really
sometimes
aggressive.
You're like...
No, you might shank a shot.
Yeah, yeah.
Sure. I'm talking about there's certain holes at... There's certain holes
them?
At DDO where the shot is to throw it wide.
Oh, okay.
Because obviously discs don't fly straight.
Yeah.
The shot is to throw it wide... and then have it come into the fairway, and the people are not, it's not like you're just throwing over them. They're like here, and the fairway's here. You're throwing this way, and you're literally having it. Does that make sense?
Oh, okay.
You're not initially just throwing over them, and then it fades in. You're having it fade in to where they are.
Yeah.
And a lot of times, like maybe playing that skip from out of bounds, inbounds.
I did hear Nate Doss mentioned that he had talked to Eric McCabe, and Eric McCabe had a notebook that he was writing down what changes he wanted to make for Worlds. And Nate Doss did say the majority of them weren't hole changes. The majority of them were spectator changes of where they wanted spectators to no longer be now watching players play.
Yeah.
Was there a problem like having too many spectators and not enough space?
No.
Plenty of space.
Did they sell out the spectator passes?
No clue.
Okay.
No clue.
I just wasn't sure if it was like another
one
of those.
How much money did I make? I haven't seen.
As of this morning, I don't think the payouts have been posted.
They still haven't been posted?
As of this morning.
Did they get posted on Wednesday? Oh, they just got posted.
What do you think? Brody, do you like the Hypercane?
It's a
or
public
the
thing. Anyone can look it up.
Better.
It's not like a... What?
Do you like the Hypercane?
Unless they don't know my Hunter.
What do you like, the Hypercane or the?
I like the Hypercane more.
Oh, okay.
I feel like it's more controllable for my arm speed.
$2,265.
Did the winner still get 8,000? That's what the projected
8,600.
And went up.
Yeah, Simon second, 5,100.
Nice.
So that
Hypercane or Force?
That putt, that was a $900 putt.
Big time.
I'm a Force guy now. Yeah. I'm whatever's most overstable.
Oh, okay.
Whatever the Hypercane I thought was super overstable, it was not overstable enough for the wind. So I have that Eagles Crossing Force. Oh, chef's kiss. Very good.
All right.
So whatever's the most overstable and won't flip.
It's hard to find.
Very hard to find.
Brody.
Yo.
Who are the celebs or other sport athletes you would like to see play the Pro-Am style tournament?
Could care less. Next question.
All right.
I want to see a tennis pro just because I'd be fascinated.
I mean, it's just anyone. Like, that's the thing. There's not like a specific person of like...
Big Cat.
Yeah, like any...
It was supposed to be there.
Any...
How did we drop the ball on that? I'll never forgive whoever dropped the ball on that. You will never be forgiven by me.
Any big celebrity or any big athlete, I think, would be very interesting to watch play disc golf. It'd be exciting to watch.
Yeah. No, yeah.
So, like,
sure.
I'm not going
to...
Like,
I'd like to see a disc in, like, Shaquille O'Neal's hands. It would look like a mini.
Yeah, like, his hands are way larger than
mine. That's what I'm saying. Like, him throwing that... That'd be crazy.
He could almost like,
he probably wouldn't be very good.
We should send him one.
Just say, hey, take a picture holding this and send it back to
him. He used to follow me on Twitter.
We got an in.
Hold on.
There we go.
Hold on. I think it was Twitter. I think I actually DM'd him one time because I think I was trying to set up a battle where I would throw Frisbees, like Scoobers, free throws, and he would shoot free throws and we'd see who would make the most.
Surely you would have won that.
I would think so, but maybe not.
I mean, you had to make one out of 10.
Or you?
Him. Brody.
Okay, he still follows me.
Shaq sucks at free throws. That's his whole thing.
I don't follow basketball.
That's going to be the weirdest DM you ever send. Hey,
yo, can I send a frisbee to you? Disc golf. Yeah, he still follows me.
Oh. We're in.
Can I send you some disc golf discs?
Okay, that's a much better way to work it.
I want to see if you can throw them with your massive hands.
There it is. There's no way around it.
Yo, check your DMs. Dude, social media is a wild place sometimes. When social media first came out, like, it was so crazy to where it's like you could just have conversations with people.
Yeah, that was like the whole draw of Twitter.
Yeah, like
it still is to a certain degree.
Kinda. You could like talk to a famous
person could just respond to you and you'd be like, oh my God.
Oh, because it's much easier to get someone's attention on Twitter than like direct DM. Because
I was cleaning out my phone because I have so many videos on here that I'm like, I don't need this stuff anymore. And this is one of the, where is it? Yeah. I still have this screenshot. I got to keep it. The very top.
Taylor Swift retweeted you?
Yeah.
That's what Twitter was.
Yeah. It was like, oh my God, Taylor Swift saw my video and she retweeted it. That's crazy. Yeah, it was. Gosh, those were the days. It was such a cool. It was such a cool thing. Now it's so toxic. It's so cancel-y.
That'll happen.
All right, we have anything else, Silas?
Here's a good one to end on.
Okay, all right,
perfect.
Give it to us.
Disc golf won't break into the major sports realm until the NPO and FPO start touring separately.
I think that's pretty far down on what's holding us back.
Yeah, I don't think that.
You think that's false?
I don't think it wouldn't.
I don't think that's the hindering factor.
Yeah, I don't. I don't think that is something that would hurt it from becoming more popular. I don't know if that's the right way of saying it. I just don't think that is like a top.
Yeah, I don't 10 think that's the main 15 factor.
Thing that's holding it
because like
back.
Realistically, what has to happen for that to happen is the FPO field needs to have demand like 2 or 3 times the size it currently is, because a tour of like 30 people or 40 people isn't going to survive. but a tour of 120 people could survive.
Right.
So like that's more
and
that
then you
side,
have
but,
like the couples that tour together.
Well, that's just gonna happen.
Would they
in this scenario, there's enough money in both fields that's not a concern. Because it's going to be really easy for you to both make your own living and do your thing. But regardless, I mean, obviously, it's not nearly as fun for people, but that's just like a different lifestyle. Like right now, if you're playing in the WNBA and your husband's in the NBA, you're never expecting to be playing in the same arena every night.
Yeah.
Like that just, right. That'd be wild.
Yeah. You're in two different careers.
What do you think of the cornhole bowling putt? Should it be made illegal?
No.
No, it shouldn't be illegal. If anything, I think it's actually a really difficult putt to get good at.
What do you think of it from like 30 feet as like a way to generate more power for someone like, I don't know, 9-something rated in the mid-900s that's struggling from 30 feet? Like, you think it's something that type of person should try out? No, just no specifics.
So I would, what I would do, and again, it's like, it'd be tough to do this because like for me, like when I practice my step putter, step putt, I'm practicing releasing the disc and then stepping.
Yeah.
So I don't think if you have that step putt that you should practice an illegal step putt as well. But if you don't have a step putt at all, and let's say you do a jump putt or you do something separately, then that might not be the worst idea of like practicing where your disc, you know, your mini is here and you start here, right? Like normal. And then you step putt and you like actually
step into
and
your
then,
life
and then putt. Like that, you could be onto something there.
Yeah.
I feel like that would generate more power.
It would definitely generate more power.
You're probably less accurate.
That's the question. Is like, can you do it accurately?
Yeah.
But if you're struggling on getting the disc to the basket from like 30 feet.
I would just say just do a little scoob if you're showing with power from 30 feet.
I'm going to struggle a lot more with accuracy that way than a step putt.
Just this. A little just right at it. I didn't make a scoober.
No?
And I almost went for it on 18 on the third round. I was like 35 feet up high,
yeah,
looking down at the water. And I asked my caddy and I was like, where am I at right now? He's like, you're four back. And I was like, all right, four back sounds doable. So I just laid up. But
I must say
I wanted to do it because I threw like four scoobers that round. I almost made two.
The hole that you did your like playthrough on Eagles Crossing with the big tower and you scoobered it in for three.
Yeah.
Crazy three now that I played it. That was insane.
All right. How big is that?
Like, oh, the tower's massive.
Texas State's is like a mini version of it.
Yeah. What was wild to me is like your depth perception is so thrown off.
It's 30 feet.
Yeah. So like
30 feet elevation change?
Not 30 feet.
It's close.
20. Really? Maybe the top of the basket's like 25 and the bottom of the basket's like 20.
It's close.
That's a lot bigger.
Well, what's crazy is like when you're on the tee, you can see the top like three or four mounds.
Yeah, it doesn't look that
big. It looks like the basket's way closer to you and it doesn't look like that mound's that tall.
Yeah.
So then we threw our first shot and then.
You guys both got out of the water? No problem?
No, we didn't even try to go over the water.
Oh, you didn't try to clear the water. Oh, I guess it is like 400 feet.
We laid up.
To the left?
Yeah, so we laid up left.
Okay.
Then we laid up to where your drive
was.
Then we went across.
Then you went across. Okay.
Yeah, to go across the water in
it's
one.
It's a 400-foot carry.
That was
crazy.
Yeah. And then after that, it's still a very difficult shot, blind over water.
Second shot's pretty
easy. It
depends
on where you got to.
Second shot's actually pretty easy.
Where we were, it was very easy. But we had laid up and then laid up around
the
corner.
Got around the
trees. We were past the trees up pushing that OB. Mm-hmm. That was easy. But if we would have barely went across the water and tried going for it.
Yeah.
No
chance. If you haven't seen the Skins match, my... spoiler, I'll just spoil what happened to me on that hole. So I crossed the water, but like I'm on the hill.
Okay. Because
there's a pretty like good little hill there. Mm-hmm. So I'm on the hill. So I end up basically running up to a different angle of where I wanted to release it on because I couldn't do a normal run up or I'd be like just sprinting up a hill. So like I run up this way and chuck it that way and it ends up coming in, hyzers, hits the bottom of the tear cake and then just launches into the water.
They didn't have the fountain on when we played, so I didn't get to see the fountain.
I think the fountain comes and goes.
Okay.
You might like not having it on because when
they
we
said it made it where you couldn't see the basket as much.
Well, also when we had it, when we were playing, it was very windy and so like it just misted the crap out of it. You just got soaked. It was like going into one
I saw
of those,
it.
Like,
it's out now. They
came out today.
Yeah, it came out. If you haven't seen it, check it out. GK Pro Skins, biggest skins match of all time.
Yeah.
It was like 20-some thousand.
I think it was more than that.
It was a lot of money.
I think it was like close to 30,000.
A lot of money was on the line. But there you have it. Thank you all so much for tuning in.
Oh, shout out to Matt Bell, $25,000.
Yes. Was donated something, right? Was it for charity or did it go to him?
I have no idea. I know
it was charity.
I know, I'm not sure, but I know he and Barsby, because like Barsby like bear hugged the crap out of him afterwards. And Barsby's a very like energetic person when it comes to like cheering on other people. So it's not like that uncommon, but I didn't realize that they had like a deal where if the other person made it, the other person got like 10 or 20% or something.
Oh,
like
wow. Dang.
So I think it made like Barsby like $2,500 or something.
That's pretty awesome.
Yeah, which is, I thought was a sweet little.
It was inside. A cool ace. And then Big Germ hit it as well in the tournament.
Yeah. And Chloe Alice.
Yes, I saw that too.
And Blair.
They're all on
video. And Blair did it the day before in a practice round.
Was Blair's on video?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't see Blair's.
He did. He posted on Instagram. So there's four aces on that hole.
Wild.
Yeah, nuts.
If you've been waiting for our St. Louis battles to come out, the Bogey Bro battles, we pushed them back a week. We had to get some stuff figured out with the sponsorship thing. So that's coming out next Tuesday. And then next Tuesday is the one where we play against the Gateway Bros, what we're going to call them, Gateway Boys. It was actually Nico's brother. And spoiler alert, this guy can crush. He was throwing like 650 all over us. You're not going to miss that. That's next Tuesday at just local St. Louis course. And then the week after that, long awaited, we play Eagles Crossing. And it's tough. You're gonna see it. It's tough for everyone. So I'm not saying it's tough like we just got wiped. I'm saying it's
a hard
tough.
Course.
It's a tough course.
If you're also in the area, our store officially opens this Saturday at 3 p.m. We will be here for a signing from, I don't know if we've decided how long.
We haven't decided the official time, but probably like 3 to 5 range. I think the store will be open till 7 p.m. So if you just want to stop in, just shop what's in the store. But yeah, we'll all be here for a signing from like 3 to 5 or so.
Yeah, we've got the...
if there's still a lot of people trying to get discount, yeah, we'll stay longer. Chilling, yeah. It's not a hard cutoff, yeah. But that's kind of the range.
We've got the Dark Horse Raptors too for those.
We should have some Foundation custom stamps.
Some Foundation custom stamps.
The P2s are in. And the rest of our Innova stuff might be coming in this week in time. So it's a brand new stamp. I'm pretty excited about it.
We're not entirely sure about like... how many people are going to show up? So it's like, I don't know if like, if you show up at 255, if you're going to be the first one in line or if you're the 50th
person. Yeah, I don't know what
we have no idea how many people are going
to
show up.
I'm very excited.
We are stoked.
Stylus is security. So stay in line.
A lot of...
I am?
Yeah.
All right. You better watch out.
A lot of time and effort has been put into this, and these guys all did an incredible job. So I'm excited for you guys to all see it this Saturday. If you're interested in the exact location, that is on our Instagram's Foundation Disc Store.
Yeah.
You can also, if you follow it, you can also win this disc, like I said earlier. So check that out. We'll be here Saturday from 3 to 5. Hope to see all you guys out there. Should be fun. Good times. Check the mic and make sure it sound right, boys.